Hello and welcome to another episode of the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. In this episode, we're going to be looking at the story of Howard Snyder, a B-17 Flying Fortress pilot flying with the US 8th Air Force from Britain. Through letters Howard wrote to his wife and exhaustive research, his son Steve has pieced together the remarkable story of his father and what happened after his plane was brought down in Belgium. The book is Shot Down. But before we get to Steve, I'd like to take a moment to thank all those new patrons of the show who came aboard in the last month or so. Keep your eyes peeled, as I do have a little extra for you. For those of you who are not already patrons, I could use your help. A dollar or so from each one of you helps me to find the time to put the show together. So for more information how to become a patron, head over to patreon.com/ww2podcast, or if patron is not your thing and you prefer PayPal, go to ww2podcast.com/support. Steve, thanks for joining me. Let's start by looking at your father pre-war. What was your father doing in 1939 when the war broke out?
Oh, in 39, he was 24. He went to high school, but he didn't go on to college. You know, not that many people went to college back then, actually. He was working for a clothing store, Desmond's Clothing in Los Angeles. There was a chain they had, I forget now off the top of my head, but they had quite a few stores in Southern California. And so he was an assistant warehouse manager there. So he was into clothes. He was kind of a dapper guy. So that's what he was doing when the war broke out.
Did he know what was coming? I mean, he volunteers for the army. Why did he volunteer for the army?
Well, that was really a result of the first peacetime draft in U.S. history implemented by President Franklin Roosevelt in the fall of 1940. So all the men, you know, in his age, I think it was 25 to 35 initially, had to register for the draft. And so he registered. And then in April of 1942, he actually went into the army.
But he ends up in the Air Force. So how does he get from the army to the Air Force?
Well, he went into the army in April of 41. And then he married my mother, Ruth Hempel, in July of 1941. You know, the war broke out. Pearl Harbor was bombed by Japan on December 7th of 41. And things were in a great upheaval at that time. My mother was very concerned about the future that was very uncertain. So she went up to Washington, the state of Washington, where my dad was stationed over Christmas that year. And she got pregnant. And so my dad was worried, like, well, how am I going to support this, my new family? I got a new bride, baby on the way, and he didn't think he could do it very well on a private's pay in the Army. So he decided to volunteer for the Air Force where he could make more money, especially if he could make it through pilot training, become an officer. He would be able to make more money and then better provide for his family. So that's why he went into the Air Force.
It's one of those wonderful practical things that rather than any sort of flag waving anything else, it's kind of, he needed money, his wife's pregnant.
It's all about the money.
Yeah. And how did he manage with flight training? Because, you know, the planes were still relatively new. They must have been like, you know, this was like, oh, like astronauts now. You know, this is a really new technology. It was, you know, real cutting edge stuff. How did he get on with flight training?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, back then, you know, there weren't that many people that flew airplanes. They were mostly all biplanes. In fact, in primary training, the first stage of pilot training, he flew a Sturman, you know, biplane. And then that's where he soloed for the first time. But it was pretty exciting stuff back then. Flying in airplanes.
Do you have the letters going back that far? Did he find it all rigorous, the flight training? I mean, you can't have struggled that much with it. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been a pilot.
Right. Well, it was going through pilot training was very difficult because 40% of the men who went into pilot training got washed out. because it was very hard. Not only was, you know, you had to learn how to fly, but you had to learn mathematics and physics and a lot of different mental disciplines to be a pilot. His big problem during pilot training was that he missed his wife because they had just gotten married. And, you know, then he had to be separated. So he missed her a great deal. And he expressed that in the letters that he wrote to my mother while he was in pilot training. But then once he got through the three stages, they were primary, basic, and advanced training. And then he graduated from advanced pilot training in April of 1943. Then the other training, as far as transitional training, where he learned how to fly a B-17 four-engine bomber, and then on to operational crew training, where the various members of the crew came together and they learned to operate as a team. The officers could have their wives with them. So at least during those phases, you know, that were actually both in Texas, my mother moved down there and they could spend, you know, time together. So they were reunited there. But he enjoyed the pilot training, you know, much more when he was reunited with his wife and also his little infant girl at this time.
This is a question that just came to me when I was reading the book. So I don't know if you're aware, in the RAF, what the way they put crews together was to sort of push them all into a hangar, all the men, and just say, okay, make crews. And these guys who often never met before would have to go around and introduce themselves to one another and say, well, I'm looking for a gunner and I'm a pilot. And eventually they'd have the crews. How was his crew put together? I mean, did they just sort of issued crew, you know, here's your crew, or do you have any, do you know how they came up with the crews?
Yeah. The Air Force, they just assigned guys. I don't know, you know, how they did that actually. But, you know, there was and I have, you know, still a copy of this, of an order issued that this is, you know, Howard Snyder's the pilot. And then these are going to be the men on his crew. And you're ordered to report to Paiute Army Airfield in Texas to begin, you know, operational crew training. So they were just assigned, you know, randomly. I really don't know how they did that. Another thing that was interesting, though, was the guys that went through pilot school. You know, they assigned one to be the lead pilot and one to be the co-pilot. I think a lot of that was kind of random, although my dad, I think several reasons why my dad became a lead pilot or the first pilot is that he was a lot older than most of the other guys. Well, at that time, he was 27 when he became a lead pilot. Plus, he was married and he had a family, so he was responsible. He had been a manager at a department store, so he had some leadership ability. He was the captain on his high school basketball team. So I think a lot of factors led that, well, you know, he might be a good, you know, a leader. That's just my feeling, though. I don't know if that was true.
I'm sure it is, because, you know, 20 compared to the rest of the young, I say young kids, you know, 27, they all look good to me, but he would, to the 18 year olds, he would seem like the old man at 27.
Yeah, especially being married and working, you know, because a lot of them, some of his members, especially the gunners, you know, they were 18 years old, they were just out of high school, you know.
And especially married with children, so again, add sort of a gravitas of age to them. You got kids?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to find a girl on my first date.
Yeah, exactly. Now, they're posted to Britain. How did your father feel about leaving his wife and baby daughter? Because, you know, there's no way they will be following him. And there's probably no way he would want them to follow him to war-torn Britain.
He and his crew reported to the 306 bomb group in Thurlow, England, on October 21st of 1943. He said that was pretty an exciting time. I mean, all the country was behind the war effort at that time. And it was exciting from the standpoint that a lot of these guys, you know, they hadn't traveled at all during their lives. Back then, you know, you didn't get on a plane. You know, there was no commercial travel. It was very provincial. Most of the United States was very rural at that time. you know, people lived in the country. They didn't live in big cities. They only associated with people like themselves in a little old town. You know, guys had never been out of their county, let alone all of a sudden they're finding themselves halfway around the world in England fighting a war. So it was very, very exciting for him at that time.
Yeah, I got the feeling he found it quite thrilling. Do you think they were surprised at what they found in Britain?
Yeah, I think it was a big shock for all the GIs. You know, it was a shock for the Brits having all these Americans come over. And there was a shock for the Americans because everything was so comparatively so old. 500-year-old buildings were new in Britain. The United States, you know, it's just so young. And even though, you know, if both the Brits and the Americans speak English, it was a different type of English. The weather was a lot different. The people were different. The customs were different. It was a shock. It was a big learning experience.
I thought his reminiscences about his trips to London were really interesting. I mean, what if you could tell us about those?
Most of those came from letters that he had written to my mother while he was stationed in England. And unlike most guys that wrote back home, my dad was very candid in what he wrote in those letters to my mother. He wrote about, you know, what life was like on the base, what life was like in England and London at the time, what bombing missions were like, escapades, as she referred to, of members in his crew. And so that was fascinating. That's one of the things that really got me, you know, my passion, you know, running high to learn more about my dad and his crew because of these stories he told about going into England, trying to shop for things to send home to my mother. Which was, you know, with rationing going on in Britain at the time, it was tough to find stuff and it was expensive. The blackouts, you know, trying to just get around London. You get lost all the time because you couldn't see where you were going. It was so dark going into the pubs or the speakeasies and drinking and, you know, having a jolly old time. And these guys were young, the first time away from home. The first, they could do anything they wanted to, really. They didn't have peers or their church or their family. You know, they could start drinking. You know, a lot of these guys had never drank before, never smoked before, didn't have sex before. And all of a sudden they could get all that in London when they went into town. So it was quite an experience for those guys.
They came across, it seemed to come across very much as sort of, all right, it's wartime, but there's an element of fun to them going to London, sort of excited tourists, but they're not just, it's kind of like almost like going to Disneyland, you know, it's so alien that it's completely thrilling.
And also at that time, there was no other city like London in the world at that time. I mean, it was really the center. And because of the Nazi occupation of many countries in Europe, you had all sorts of different nationalities of soldiers that had Frenchmen. You had Belgians. You had Poles. You had all these different nationalities coming in there during the war. So it was really an unusual place there was during that time.
I mean, do you know what the routine was for these airmen on the, you know, your father on the bases? I mean, how often were they allowed to go and do their own thing compared to actually flying time?
Well, they did a lot of practice flying when they got to England because really, you know, they had their training in the U.S., but really they didn't have that many hours of training, you know, especially of formation flying. They did a lot of formation flying, learned to fly tight formations to defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. And so a lot of time was spent training. A lot of times the weather in England, you know, was bad and they couldn't fly because it was the overcast or the clouds. And so they had a lot of downtime. How often they got a pass for the weekend or a leave, I'm not really sure about that. But they were, as you referred to, Thurlow was about 60 miles north of London, a little bit northwest of London. So it wasn't that long of a train ride to get into London. Any guy loved to get off the base and get into London and get all that excitement. You know, if they couldn't, then, you know, at least they could get off the base locally. Thurlow, typically they went into Bedford because Thurlow was in Bedfordshire. and went into the pubs there and around that area.
My mother recalled growing up that, because I'm surrounded by RAF and Canadian bomber bases, my mother recalls growing up that if a bicycle went missing, invariably it turned up one of the airfields, because they one of the airmen had to get back in a hurry because after a night out, and it was just taken and thrown in a hedge bag.
All those guys had bicycles. That was their main form of transportation. It was interesting that I forget who it was now. He used to like to just go out to the entrance to the base and watch guys come back at night, with all these guys would be riding their bicycles from the local little villages drunk, and they'd be falling off their bicycles and going into ditches.
I have to say, it all does sort of sound, that life when they're not flying sounds relatively, I don't know if glamorous is the thing, but possibly fun, if the war wasn't getting in the way for them. So the missions, and how much do you know about the missions? You know, there's a long missions. Are they daylight bombing or are they night bombing at this point?
The U.S., the 8th Air Force, they just bombed during the day. You know, they had as a result of the Casablanca Agreement with Churchill and Roosevelt, it was agreed that they'd have around-the-clock bombing. The British would bomb at night, and the Americans would bomb during the day. So they would just bomb Germany, you know, they'd give them no rest. They'd just bomb continually, trying to bomb them into submission. But flying combat was extremely dangerous. A combat airman in the 8th Air Force during World War II was the most hazardous duty assignment in the United States military. 26,000 men died in the 8th Air Force. That's more than the entire Marine Corps fighting in the Pacific for the U.S. And another 28,000 men became prisoners of war after their bombers were knocked out of the sky by either German aircraft, anti-aircraft fire, or German fighter planes. It was hazardous duty. That was another thing that was unique, because, you know, one moment you're in the sky facing death on these bombing missions, and then that same night or the next day, you could be in London partying. And I think that's one reason they party hard, is that the next day they might be dead.
Do you know how your father found these missions? Did he find them taxing? Did he pass that on to your mother?
Yeah, he wrote about bombing missions in his letters to my mother. And, you know, that when he first went up, you know, he was nervous, but then after a while, he said that he got used to them, and he wasn't frightened. You know, even though they're facing the flak and different things, he settled in. And, you know, like I think most of those guys did, you know, when they got in that plane, they had a job to do, and they had a crew members that were counting on each other. And so, you know, they focused, and the fear kind of left them, and they had a lot of adrenaline running through their bodies. But they focused on the job that they had to do.
What surprised me is the tempo. I mean, he writes, you know, we've had two in 2 days. At another point, he says, you know, three months, and now three in 3 days. All right, three in 3 months isn't a lot, but three in 3 days, if they're 10-hour missions, the turnaround time to fly back, you know, get yourself prepared, the machines get overhauled, and the tempo for those 3 in 3 days must have been terrific, the strain on them.
Yeah, you know, they didn't know, they never knew when they were going to go up. I mean, when my dad was there, they had implemented a 25 mission limit. If you flew 25 missions, you could go back home. And they all wanted to fly missions. You know, they hated it when the weather was bad and they couldn't fly, or a mission had to be aborted because of mechanical failure or weather, and they'd have to return to England. They just wanted to fly their missions, and they wanted to get back home. And as you say, those missions lasting 6 to 10 hours were extremely tiring. Being up in the air that long, especially for the pilots, because they had to stay alert at all times. If you were a gunner, you could kind of sleep for a while before you got over enemy territory. But those pilots, it was both mentally and physically strenuous. Not only was the missions lengthy, But they had to stay alert at all times, flying in those tight formations. If they lost their concentration, they could clip a wing on the plane next to them or run on the plane in front of them and go down. They had to continually fight the turbulence, not only the weather turbulence, but all the air turbulence of all those bombers being in such close proximity to one another. The wake turbulence and the prop wash would just churn the air, so it'd be like a washing machine. And back then, you really had to fly those planes. It took muscle to fly those planes. And the co-pilot flew the plane as much as the pilot. They traded off because they got so tired.
And these machines, they could take some punishment. The B-17 is well known for being really be able to take a pounding. And so before we get to your father being brought down, I mean, I wonder if you could tell us about, I mean, he certainly had some close scrapes, didn't he, after they've taken some punishment.
One thing I'll state, though, that a lot of people don't realize, a lot of people think that one crew, a B-17, had a 10-man crew. They just flew all their missions together. But that was hardly ever the case. Because of the English weather, there were always guys getting sick, coming down with the flu, pneumonia. And so you always had to have replacements for different crew positions. And then guys would get injured, either from flak or for a lot of guys, frostbite was a huge problem. It was minus 40 to 60 degrees below zero in those bombers at the altitude that they were flying. And one of my dad's waste gunners, John Pindrock, he spent a couple months in the hospital with serious frostbite wounds. So you constantly had replacement crew members on the crews. They didn't fly the same crew. Also, they didn't fly the same plane, at least in the early years of the war, because they would get shot up and they'd have to go in for repair. My dad, I think he flew five different B-17s during his combat missions there. And there would be engines that go out and that, kind of limp back home and different things. So there was always one problem or another.
Well, there's one occasion when he's a co-pilot and the engine's hit by flak.
Well, he was the captain on the basketball team at the base there, and he tore the ligaments in his ankle. And he couldn't fly for 2 months. So some of his other crews had more missions than him. But when he came back from that 2 month leave, he had to fly as co-pilot for a couple of times to get himself, back in the swing of things. And as you mentioned, he was flying the co-pilot in one of those missions where a couple of engines were knocked out. Fortunately, no enemy fighters came and got him on that mission. But it was touch and go for a while.
What hadn't directly occurred to me is that once they start to lag behind, they have to fall out of that bomber stream, and their whole defence is built around that bomber stream. So once that B-17's on its own, it's extremely vulnerable.
Absolutely, yeah.
And they must have been sweating flying back over the continental Europe to get to that English Channel as... It would have been a welcome sight.
Oh, yeah.
Now, your father's look, well, obviously your father's look runs out. As you said, he gets injured with his ligament injury. So the crew carry on flying, his crew carry on flying without him.
Well, they split up as crew and, some of them would fly with one pilot. Some of them would be assigned to a different pilot. His crew just didn't stay together and they got a new pilot. They just split up his crew and they went and flew with a bunch of different pilots. Actually, my dad and my dad's full crew, his plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time he went overseas. They only flew two missions together as a full 10-man crew.
I hadn't realized that. So I was going to say, after 2 months, he'll have come back and his official crew will have overtaken him in their mission count.
Well, some of them did, some of them didn't, because of illness or injury. My dad's a Baltic gunner. When they were coming back, they got some turbulence and he fell in the plane and hurt his back and he was in the hospital. There was always something going on. So probably half the crew had more missions than him, and then half had the same or possibly less. There were some that had less missions than he did, even though he was out for 2 months.
That's funny, isn't it? So your father's look does eventually, it does eventually run out and they're shot down. I wonder if you could tell us about that mission.
Sure. It was February 8th of 1944. They were on a mission to Frankfurt. And they dropped their bombs successfully, but the bomb bay doors got hit by flak and they couldn't get them back up. And as a result, that caused the drag in the plane. They lost airspeed and they started lagging behind the formation. And unfortunately, at that time, the U.S. fighter escorts left the formation to go out to get involved in a dogfight with some German fighters. And so they were really left exposed. And a couple German Focke-Wulf 190 fighters singled my dad's plane out, and they came in and shot down the Susan Ruth. Two crew members were killed in the plane. The other eight were able to bail out successfully. But both those two German Focke-Wulf fighters were shot down. One piloted by Siegfried Merrick crashed, and he died in the plane. He's buried in Belgium. And the other pilot, Hans Berger, he was able to bail out, and he made it through the war. During my research, this is a pretty amazing. I still am amazed by it. One day, my wife asked, why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane? Like, it was easy to do, no big deal. And I thought, well, she doesn't know what she's talking about. What a dumb question. Or, you know, there's no way in the world I'm going to be able to do that. But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do. And lo and behold, I found Hans Berger and interviewed him for the book. And he gave me some wonderful insight that's in the book about what it was like to go up against the Eighth Air Force. Fortunately for me, Hans became a translator after the war, so he speaks perfect English. And he's still living. He's turned 95 years old last October. And we've become good friends, and we keep in touch now and then.
Wonderful. It's probably unlikely, but did he actually remember you attacking your dad's the Susan Ruth?
Oh, he does. He doesn't remember hardly any details. He just remembers about attacking the B-17, and then he has to bail out of his plane because the gunners on my dad's plane shot up his plane. And then he bailed out, and then he bailed out over occupied Belgium. So the Germans picked him up, and then he got back to his base. When I visited Hans in Munich, Germany, is where Hans lived, he brought out his flight log and turned to his entry in his flight log, February 8th, 1944, were recorded, you know, shooting down a B-17, and he had to bail out. You know, and I took pictures of that. You know, that I have chills as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's one of those moments where hairs of the back of your neck goes up when a book like that's produced. How on earth did you manage to find him? You didn't just type his name into Google or something as simple as that. How do you track him down?
Well, I went on Google initially and just entered trying to find a Luftwaffe pilot, and a couple of forums came up, internet forums, which I joined, and I posted inquiries on those forums because I knew the day my dad was shot down, the location where he was shot down, the time of day where he was shot down. And in a week, two guys got back to me. One from England and one from Belgium. And the guy from Belgium actually was a Luftwaffe, or is a Luftwaffe historian, written a number of books about the Luftwaffe and knew Hans Berger. And on that day, there were 12 B-17s shot down. And the one shot down south of Chimay, Belgium, was shot down by Hans Berger. And so I asked him to put me in contact with Hans, and he contacted Hans and asked me if it was okay for me to contact him, which he did. And then for the book, actually, I interviewed him through email and over the telephone. It wasn't until after I wrote the book that I went to Munich, Germany, and actually met him in person. So actually, it was pretty easy to find him. I thought it'd be impossible because most likely, you know, most of those Luftwaffe pilots were killed during the war. And it's 70 years later, you know, he probably passed away by now. I can't speak German, so how am I going to talk to him anyway? But everything just fell in place. That was just amazing.
Yeah, as I say, that's just amazing. You'd have thought that if, you know, because those Luftwaffe pilots just flew till they died or the war ended. So
not only did they not have mission limits, they didn't have passes. They didn't have leaves, leave of absence. They just went up every day. Amazing. Most all his sons were killed.
Absolutely. So your father gets out of the plane as it comes down. How is his? I mean, I presume they trained for this. How was his escape from the from a B-17 that's no doubt out of control? And at some point, he's had to say abandon ship.
Exactly. It's on fire. They have to bail out. they tell them what to do, but none of those guys had ever jumped out of a plane before. It's not like paratroopers where you practice jumping out of a plane. So, they jump out and, they're told, count so many seconds, and then until you see objects, he doesn't see anything. And so he counts, and then he counts over, and then he gives up counting. And he just, he's coming down through clouds, sometimes he can see the ground, sometimes he can't. But then once he sees, I think he can identify objects on the ground, like buildings or trees, he decides to pull the chute. And he comes down successfully, except his parachute, he lands in trees, and his parachute gets hung up in these trees, and he's dangling 20 feet off the ground, and he can't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple young Belgian gentlemen, saw him coming down and came to rescue him before the Germans got to him, because they had patrols in the area looking for these guys that had bailed out. So they went back to a farmhouse, got a ladder and a rope, and helped him down the tree. He was shot down around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. They told him to stay put because it was too dangerous to try to move him during the daylight. But they'd come back that night and pick him back up, which they did. And they took him to the farmhouse of one of the Belgium guys that found him. Raymond Durvan is his name, who's still alive, by the way. And they took him to this farmhouse. He stayed there one night. My dad had some shrapnel wounds and some burn wounds, which Raymond Durvan's mother, Ida, patched up. And then that night they decided to move him because they thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that with those German patrols in the area. So a Belgium customs officer, Paul Tilcan, came and got him on a tandem bicycle, and they took off and moved him to another location.
It's when he's with his tandem, isn't it, that he bumps into the Germans? Is that the right on the timeline?
Yes. Yeah. They took
give us that, because that's a wonderful story.
Yeah. They took out at night. It was pitch black. My dad said it was raining, and he could only pedal with one leg because of the shrapnel wounds in his other leg. So when the pedal came around, he would push down with his good leg, and they came to a hill, and they weren't able to pedal up the hill, so they got off the bike and started pushing it up the hill. And when he got to the top of the hill, there was a little cabaret there. The lights were on. People were talking loudly, laughing. Music was playing. And all of a sudden, two German officers came out with their arms around young Belgian or French girls. My dad said they were schnockered. And one of them comes up to my dad, puts his arm around him, and asks him for a light for his cigarette. My dad can't speak French. He can't speak German, so he's petrified. But Paul, luckily, could converse, lit the guy's cigarette, and then they let him on their way. My dad said that they were too drunk and too interested in these young girls to pay too much attention to a couple of jokers that were pushing a bike up in the rain up the hill. So that was a close call, and he had a number of close calls, almost being captured by the Germans.
I mean, that's straight out of some Hollywood film, is that kind of scene.
Yeah, you can't make this stuff.
Now, your father goes into hiding. How organized is sort of this resistance? I don't know if it's resistance. When he's in hiding, how is it all put together? Has he just sort of passed from one family to another as they feel?
Well, they had there were different underground groups or cells, and then each area had their little, village. He came down in southern Belgium, just north of the French border, which is all rural farmland, just little hamlets and villages scattered here and there. The largest little town nearby was Chimay, and the leader of the resistance there, Albert Delpore, he was kind of the supervisor of that district, and so they would be in communication. And basically, after they moved him from that initial farmhouse, they moved him all over the place, from place to house to house. How long he stayed in any given place depended on how brave the people were who lived there and how dangerous the underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might spend one night at one house or might spend 6 weeks at another house. So he moved around a lot. Certain occasions he almost got discovered. But the people in the underground who hid him or any downed airman for that matter, were unbelievably brave people. They risked their lives and those of their family and friends to aid downed airmen. If the German secret police, the Gestapo, found out, they would be arrested, tortured, and either shot, executed, or sent to concentration camps. And some of the Belgian people that helped my dad and his crew did meet that fate.
What surprised me is how many Belgian citizens seem willing to help. Because presumably, you know, I made a note of, you know, how the hell are they feeding these people? Because, you know, it's not just your father, there is other airmen thereabouts. So, you know, the Belgians would be living on rations. So yet they're having to give part of whatever they have to feed these people who are not productive.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, as you said, you know, these occupied countries, they were on rations that were issued by the occupying Germans. There was a black market that you could buy stuff. But the people that had a little money, my dad said, you know, they could, you know, buy some extra provisions. But my dad did say that they would let him sleep in their bed. They would sleep on the floor. They would give him, you know, the majority of the food to eat. They're unbelievably wonderful people. They really appreciated the fact that these Americans or the British or Canadians, whatever, were coming, leaving their countries and fighting the Germans to liberate these occupied countries from occupation. And the majority of the people were patriots. You did have a certain percentage of the people that were collaborators who either believed in fascism or they thought, well, the Germans are going to win the war, so we might as well be, you know, on their side when it's all said and done, or just people that were selfish and saw this as an opportunity to make money. And it was brutal. People would rat out friends who they didn't like. They might have had a little grudge, you know, that went back a few years, and they'd tell the Gestapo that, oh, this person's part of the resistance, and they'd be arrested. It was terrible.
Was there any chance of your father making it back to Britain? Was there any plan, if that's the right way of putting it, in place for him to get back?
Yes, normally once the underground came across downed airmen, they tried to get him back to England through various escape routes, down through France, over the Pyrenees into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. But something always went wrong trying to get my dad out for whatever reason. You know, sometimes these escape routes, they had people would get killed who were manning the escape routes, or they'd be infiltrated by collaborators or Germans. And this had to be hard on my dad because, you know, just hiding and hiding, because he was missing in action for 7 months. And, you know, he has to bail out of his plane. He comes down in a foreign country. He has no idea where he is, doesn't know what happened to the other members of his crew. Can't communicate with the U.S. military. He's dealing with people who he can't communicate with because at that point he can't speak French. Any one of these people might be a collaborator and turn him into the Gestapo. And when he's hiding, the Gestapo could break in at any moment, search the house and capture him and arrest him and either shoot him or send him to a prisoner of war camp. And finally, he got tired of hiding. Word had come that the Allies had landed at Normandy, and so the invasion of occupied Europe had begun. So he decided to join the French resistance. He had that year's training in the army in Washington, so he knew how to fight on the ground. He had that year's experience, and he wanted to get back in the fight. So the people that were hiding him was strongly disagreed with this, thought it was way too dangerous for him to try to do that. But he said, well, I'm just going to take off by myself and try to meet up with the French resistance. If you want, won't take me. But so one of his helpers, Amy Cools, he took him on. They rode bicycles over the Belgian border into France. And he hooked up with this French resistance called the Mackie group. And then he fought with the Mackie for several months
That's almost a Hollywood film in itself. Never mind the landing and being hiding from the Germans. Quite remarkable. What kind of operations they were undertaking?
The Maquis, the French Resistance, they were made up of small independent guerrilla groups that were scattered all over France. There were about 20 in my dad's group. They were led by a French lieutenant who had escaped from a German prisoner of war camp. And when he first met up with them, they didn't accept him right away. It's, you know, he could speak conversational French by then, but, you know, here's this American, they don't know who he is, because the makeup of the group were either Belgians, Frenchmen, or they had some Algerians as well. And now this, so my dad is this foreigner, so they had to take, it took a little while for them to accept him, but he probably proved himself that he knew how to fight on the ground. The resistance groups, they'd get their instructions from the British over the BBC through coded messages. They were also supplied by the British through airdrops. And the job of the resistance was to harass the Germans. They would disrupt communications, sabotage railroad lines, attack German convoys, assassinate German officers. And my dad did say that the information that the British gave him over these coded messages was unbelievably accurate. If the British said there'd be a German convoy, you know, on this date, at this time, at this place, sure enough, they'd be.
Yeah, the American army. It's the Americans who push up into his sector. I mean, do you know at what point, you know, how do you present yourself to the American? You know, do you just walk over the lines and say, "Hi, I'm a downed airman," or, and they say, "Oh, hi, welcome back." Or you know, it strikes me as being rather a risky point, that point where he has to return to the American fold, because they could, you know, it could be a collaborator, it could be all kinds of things. Do you know how that happened for your father?
Yeah, one day on September 2nd of 1944, he and his Maquis group, they had set up an ambush for a German convoy that one didn't show up that day, because at that time the Germans were just fleeing eastward in advance of the Allied push up through France. But word filtered through that there were U.S. troops in a nearby village of Trelon, France. So my dad walked into the town square, walked up to an army major. Actually, it was an element of Patton's Third Army that had come up through France after D-Day. And, you know, identified himself, and he was interrogated because, as you said, it could be some infiltrator. And then once they were satisfied that he was who he said he was, he hooked a ride with a convoy that was taking prisoners, German prisoners, to Paris. And then got on a C-47, went back to England. So 7 months after, from the time his plane was shot down till he was missing in action. Actually, my other sister was born while he was missing in action. That before he finally got back to England, and my mother got word to my mother that he was alive.
Yeah, how much were the families of the aircrew aware of what had happened from that moment they didn't return from the mission? Or was it complete blackout?
Well, they were shot down on February 8th, 44, and my mother got a telegram from the War Department on February 23rd that the plane had gone down and the crew was missing in action. There were some members of the crew that who bailed out, who were captured by the Germans and became prisoners of war. They were able to write home. The various family members, you know, there were three of the crew who were married at the time. The others weren't, but mothers or girlfriends and or wives, they would all be writing back and forth. And so word came that these three guys had been captured and were alive. They did say, though, that two of the crew had been killed. But it was assumed that the other men who had bailed out, hopefully, were prisoners of war. And hopefully at some point in time, they'd be heard from. Actually, of the remaining crewmen, the ones that weren't killed or became POWs, my dad was the first one to make it back to England. So that gave him a lot of hope. They're going, oh, Howard's back. He made it. So, you know, maybe the others are going to be shortly following him. But unfortunately, you know, that wasn't the case completely. Five of the crew made it back home, but five of them did not.
It's interesting. He wrote to Ruth saying how lucky he was to be in the Air Force, not in the infantry stuck in a foxhole. I wonder if in later life he still believed that he'd been lucky to be in the Air Force.
Even though, as I mentioned, you know, being a combat crewman was the most deadly assignment, I don't think those guys really realized it who were flying combat. They were glad that, you know, they could come back to a warm bed and, you know, good food and have a chance to party a little bit. And they just looked at it as, you know, they had a job to do and they were over there to do it. If you talk to any of these veterans, you know, they are so humble. I just talked to a 97-year-old veteran last night. He called me. He lives in Florida. He read my book and he called me up to talk about it. And all these guys are the same way. They just had a job to do. They're not heroes. You know, they just went over there, did their job, and then came back and got on with their lives. You know, we look at it, you know, to me, they were the greatest generation without a doubt. But my dad was glad that he was in the Air Force. You know, most of those guys, even though they were getting killed at such a rapid rate early, especially early in the war, you know, when you're, you know, a teenager or early 20s, you think you're invincible and you're going to live forever and that, you know, the other guy's going to get killed, but, you know, it won't be me. And most of those guys had that attitude.
Well, Steve, thanks for sharing your father's story. Listeners, if you want to read the full story and find out what happened to the rest of the crew of the Susan Ruth, the book is Shot Down by Steve Snyder. I will, of course, put a link on the website. But before I go, I have one more thing to share with you. I had an email recently from Phil Cristofaro. Phil has recently mentored four girls aged 9 to 11 in producing an interactive book telling the stories of four children growing up in Europe and their lives during World War II. It's called Convergence. It's absolutely superb. I'll put a link on the website, www2podcast.com. If you've a Mac or an iPad, go and have a look in the Apple iBook store thing. It's free, so you have no excuse. I have no idea where we'll be for the next podcast. Most probably either in Italy or on the Eastern Front. But until then, I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.